Studio 360 is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names to represent you or your business. If you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name and include all the tools and support you need to manage it. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code ARTPOP.
Today in Studio 360,
to be or not to be.
William Shakespeare was born 450 years ago this month, and his plays are still everywhere.
There's such incredible vision and power and potency in the plays and in the language that the idea that this vast array of people can find themselves, I think, is a healthy reflection of our society.
I'll talk with the director George C. Wolfe about how this playwright from four centuries ago still has such a hold over our imaginations. Plus, rappers have always talked about keeping it real. Now a lot of prosecutors are taking them as totally real and looking at rap lyrics for evidence of crimes, quasi-confessions. Should songs be admissible in court? I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. When you think of Florida, you probably think of Disney World, perpetual sun, beaches, strenuous fun, which is why it's a perfect setting for an apocalyptic sci-fi novel about some kind of alien invasion. The new Southern Reach trilogy is some of the eeriest fiction I've read in a long time, and I'll talk with its author, Jeff Vandermeer, about that later this hour. But to start the show, next month, a 23-year-old rapper in Virginia named Antoine Stewart will go on trial for a double murder. But it wasn't a gun or a fingerprint or any physical evidence that led police to Stewart as a suspect. It was the lyrics he wrote in a song called Ride Out.
Listen, walk to your boy and I approached him. 12 midnight on the trap house porch. Everybody saw when I'm a choked him. But nobody saw when I'm a smoked him. Roofed him. Chopping up the shank, then I poked him. 357 Smith & Wesson being scoped him. Roofed him. Had me cracking up, so I joked him.
Of course, violence has always been a prime subject in rap, but it's only recently that prosecutors have used songs as evidence for particular rappers' particular alleged crimes. Right now, the New Jersey Supreme Court is about to decide a case on whether one rapper's lyrics should have been admitted as evidence in his 2008 conviction and 30-year sentence for attempted murder. Charis Kubrin is a professor of criminology at the University of California at Irvine who has written about all of this a lot. Charis, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about the Vontae Skinner case that is now before the New Jersey Supreme Court. What happened there?
Well, this case is the one that's been receiving the most attention in the media, and it's important because what you have here is an individual whose 13 pages of violent rap lyrics were used against him in court without the jurors knowing, in some cases, that these lyrics were written years prior. And not only that, the lyrics constituted the central piece of evidence against Vontae Skinner. There was very little else.
Really? So the fact that the lyrics refer to his Tech N9ne gun and being in love with death and four slugs drilling your cheek to blow your face off and all that, that was the evidence mostly that gave him 30 years?
First of all, that's very common in rap music. All of those examples that you just gave, I could pull up in 50, hundreds of songs, actually, of rap lyrics. But yes, that ended up being the main evidence. I think there was eyewitness testimony that was later recanted.
Are there many established legal rules or precedents about the admissibility of something like lyrics as evidence?
Absolutely. And the problem is that they're not getting applied, at least in the case of rap lyrics. They are in other forms of artistic expression, but not when it comes to rap lyrics.
But of course, that's partly the genre's own doing, because one of its central tenets has always been to keep it real, to purport these songs as being semi-autobiographical depictions of gritty real life and to have criminal pasts and all the rest. So the problem has sort of been brought on themselves, no?
Absolutely. There's some complexity there. And that is one of the big points is that rap music uses a lot of poetic devices, things like metaphor, exaggeration, other artistic devices. And one of those artistic devices is this notion of keeping it real. And that can be confusing to people who don't understand or know much about rap music because for the most part, that's a marketing pose, right? That, too, is an artistic convention.
Yeah.
But if you don't listen to rap music or know anything about it, it may seem like, well, this person is making an autobiographical confession or an actual threat in their music.
Right. So let's say a hypothetical case where the police and prosecutors have hard evidence that this guy did this shooting or did this murder, did this thing. And they also want to introduce rap lyrics to emphasize that. Would you say, no, keep the rap lyrics out, just use the evidence? That's your position? Really?
Why bring in artistic expression that may have absolutely nothing to do with the facts of the case? And that's the problem. Across most of these cases, there is absolutely no correspondence between the lyrics and what happened in the cases, right? So there might be generic mentions of Glocks and shootings and that sort of thing, right? But that's what defines gangster rap music. So of course that's going to be there. That's the given.
I want to try something. I want to just put on a record picked almost at random. This is Dead Wrong by the late rapper Biggie Smalls.
When I get dusted, I like to spread the blood like mustard. Trust it. My hardcore rain leaves you rusted. Move over, Lucifer. I'm more ruthless. Leave you toothless. You keep it. I flip it. Tears don't affect me. I hit them with the tech. G, disrespect me. My potency is deadly. I'm shooting babies. No ifs, ands, or maybes. Hit mummy in the tummy if the hooker plays a dummy. Slip the wrist a little stiff.
Now, that's grotesque, of course, and the body count is around 4 in that song. So are police and prosecutors now just combing through YouTube looking for suspicious videos with lyrics like that? Or do they find a suspect and then say, oh, he's also rapped about this kind of thing?
Yeah, I'd say there's two basic tactics that are happening now. In most cases, prosecutors are using the lyrics, whether they found them prior or they're sifting through YouTube videos, either way, to portray these lyrics as accurate depictions of the individual's past behavior or imply that these videos, these lyrics, are reflections of an individual's criminal disposition. Like, look, if they can rap about it, they could certainly do it in life. A more sinister tactic, we argue, though, involves actually criminalizing the rap lyrics themselves. In other words, making rap lyrics the center of the case. And these individuals are charged with making terroristic threats. And I testified in a case back in 2011 that had literally the lyrics were the centerpiece of the case. This is the Olutosin Oduwale case in Illinois. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. This is a young man. He was a college student at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. They found some lyrics in a car that had ran out of gas that were rap lyrics. Everybody agreed they were rap lyrics on one side of the piece of paper. On the other side were more rap lyrics and then 6 lines of text. And these 6 lines of text are upon which the entire case rested. And the state basically argued they amounted to a terroristic threat. And he maintained and his defense maintained that they were the beginning stages of rap lyrics.
Well, now that prosecutors are making it dangerous to even do the raps, maybe that could perversely incite more of it.
That's a fair question. If you look at the history of rap music, certainly that the tension between law enforcement and rappers fueled a lot of the raps early on, if you go back to the late 80s, right? So you're absolutely right. I suspect as this tactic grows, because it's been successful among prosecutors. So now what you're starting to see, I mean, there's evidence of a training manual from the early 2000s that talked about using lyrics as a way to invade and exploit the defendant's true personality. So I think this tactic over the late 90s and early 2000s caught on among prosecutors and became a way in which to kind of sidestep the collection of traditional evidence and have something very powerful to use among jurors.
Sharis, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Sharis Kubrin is an associate professor of criminology, law, and society at UC Irvine. So what do you all think? Should a rapper's lyrics ever be admissible as evidence in a court of law? Tell us in a comment at studio360.org.
I don't pack a 9mm. Most of y'all gangsta rappers ain't hardcore neither. Whoever get mad, then I'm talking about you. Claim you fear no man, but never walk without crew. Where I'm from, your reputation don't mean jack. So what you pack gats and you sell.
When I was 13, I knew about schools of fish and gaggles of geese. But then I read this little book of my mom's called An Exaltation of Larks. And ever since, I've loved obscure collective nouns for creatures, all these actual words that seem like fictional artifacts. A parliament of owls, an ostentation of peacocks, a smack of jellyfish, a murder of crows, and so on. So I got to thinking, why don't we create some more for human types, like, for instance, people on public radio? If Terry Gross and Ira Glass and Robert Siegel and I got together, would we be a pomposity of hosts? And what would be the right collective nouns for hipsters or critics or science fiction fans? We've got a list of professional and other types at studio360.org. And we want you to create the collective plurals for each. Go to our website, visit us on Facebook, or find us on Twitter and do your best.
Our next story is Hamlet by William Shakespeare.
So, Shakespeare.
Just that everywhere I go, it's the same old thing. All anyone wants me to say is to be or not to be.
Why is he the only writer before about 1800 whose plays we really know and see?
That is the question.
Beyond sheer talent, the secret to Shakespeare's one-of-a-kind endurance, that's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Do the bit about alas, poor Yorick.
No, I'm sick of it. I want to do something else. I want to make something of my life.
No, I don't know that bit.
Studio 360 is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names along with all the tools and support you need to manage them. When you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name to personalize your blog, business, portfolio, or cat videos. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code ARTPOP.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360.
Time now for a Shakespearean play.
The hullabaloo over Shakespeare's 500th birthday is going to be epic. So thank God this month is only his 450th. Still, it is interesting to me how Shakespeare's presence in our culture has had such a resurgence during the last couple of decades. More big stage productions than ever in my lifetime, more big movie adaptations, even movies about him. In fact, on one of the very first Studio 360 episodes ever, I talked about that growing Shakespeare mania with George C. Wolfe. Wolfe was then the artistic director of the New York Shakespeare Festival, and he's still one of the most influential people in American theater. We spoke not long after Shakespeare in Love came out, and the Ethan Hawke Hamlet movie, and Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, as well as George C. Wolfe's own stage production of The Tempest, starring a man best known for captaining the Enterprise.
Then was this island, save for the sun that she did litter here, a freckled whelp, hag-born, not honored with a human shape.
Yes, Caliban, her son.
Dull thing, I say so. He that Caliban, whom now I keep in service. Thou best knowest what a torment I did find thee in. Thy groans did make wolves howl and penetrate the breasts of ever-angry bears. It was a torment to lay upon the damned, which Sycorax could not again undo. It was my art, when I arrived and heard thee, that made gape the pine and let thee out!
George, I don't know why you chose to cast Patrick Stewart other than the fact that he's a terrific actor, but the fact that he's famous as Star Trek's Captain Picard from TV does speak, I think, to the current efflorescence of Shakespeare in all kinds of unexpected places.
Exactly. Well, I mean, Shakespeare was a popular artist, so it makes perfect sense that people are now claiming him in very intimate and very personal and in a broad spectrum of ways, because I think it's so wonderful that he's been taken off of some bookshelf and is now in the mix of everybody who wants to claim it and find themselves inside of him.
Whether it's rap versions or Klingon versions on Star Trek or whatever.
Precisely, exactly. I think it's, I find that very exhilarating and very exciting, because there's such incredible vision and power and potency in the plays and in the language that the idea that this vast array of people can find themselves, I think it's a healthy reflection of our society, and it's really quite wonderful.
Is there something about this moment, and by moment I mean the last decade or so, that has caused this? Because for many years, a century, you could argue, there was a kind of diminution of Shakespeare's presence in our real lives.
Because I think that people were told that Shakespeare was not available to them, that you had to know this fact or this fact or this fact before you could find yourselves inside of it. And I think that fortunately over time through any number of things, I assume that because there are tons of like Shakespeare festivals and summer productions that have flourished all over the country in the past like 50 years, that I think by bringing it to the people have found themselves inside of it so that therefore people can claim it. And also it's great stories. It's just great stories. So it makes perfect sense that Hollywood would find it.
So the blurring of high culture and pop culture that we've seen in all realms of culture the last 20, 30 years is partly responsible for this.
I think very much so.
Romeo is Italian, always in and out of love.
Yes, that's good, until he meets
Ethel.
Do you think?
The daughter of his enemy.
The daughter of his enemy.
His best friend is killed in a duel by Ethel's brother or something. His name is Mercutio.
Mercutio. Good name.
That clip we just heard, of course, was from Shakespeare in Love.
I found the film quite wonderful because the thing which I felt as though the film captured in a very specific way is this person who we discuss as if he were a god as an in-process human being, as an in-process artist. And because any time I go inside of a play, I always try to, I don't care if it's Angels in America or The Tempest, I always go, this playwright had to write this play at this time in his life. There was some deep primal urgency which said, if I don't write this play, I will die. I will explode. My life is not capable of continuing. Because I think if you can find that urgency and that intimacy, then somehow you can make the piece breathe so a way that audiences, but more specifically the human beings who comprise an audience, can find themselves inside of the piece. So that in that film, I just love the idea that we were seeing this human being be a mess of a human being searching for a purity and an ideal and a sense of vision that was outside of himself. And the only way he could find that was by going deep inside of himself. So I found it very exhilarating.
And he was a mess of a human being, but the movie's effect, its takeaway, if you will, was not to diminish the artistic process or his genius.
At all. Simply because I think all of the components of our existence comprise the best that we have to offer, and also all the worst aspects of ourselves comprise the best that we have to offer. And that somehow I think that's very, very healthy, that we understand that that's where art comes from, the best and the worst of us.
And, of course, the fact that that film was written by Tom Stoppard, a great dramatic artist
precisely
in his own right, probably allowed us to see that.
Exactly.
The director and playwright George C. Wolfe. I talked with him in 2000 in the first season of Studio 360. We talked about all kinds of incarnations of Shakespeare's plays, the good and the not so good.
If we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here while these visions did appear, and this weak and idle theme, no more yielding but to dream. Gentles, do not reprehend. If you pardon, we will mend.
Now, that was the definitive Mickey Rooney puck, of course, from 19...
Let's retire the role.
Exactly. From A Midsummer Night's Dream in 1935. As I said earlier in the program, there was this lull in Hollywood's embrace of Shakespeare for several decades. I noticed that in the Shakespeare productions you've done, you've made a point, it seems, of casting very popular film and television actors in the leads. In your Macbeth in 1998, you had Alec Baldwin and Angela Bassett. And in The Tempest, of course, Patrick Stewart starred. Are those artistic choices on your part, or is that another way to get an audience that may not regard themselves as Shakespeare's audience to come into the theater?
I think it's both, very much so, because, I mean, if it isn't grounded in some sort of artistic reality or desire, it's not going to spring forth into a production. But at the same time, there is part of this energy of wanting to attract and seduce or drop breadcrumbs, if you will, for people who will go, oh, no, that's not for me, so that they can go inside the theater and then find themselves inside the work.
Which I guess is one of the potential salutary effects of Shakespeare appearing in comic books. I mean, obviously there are those conservatives in the Academy and elsewhere who believe that this is all a sort of debasement of civilization and making Shakespeare, dumbing down Shakespeare.
Well, I don't think so. I remember I saw a production of Othello in college, which was a particularly bad one. And I remember at the end of the production being astoundingly and deeply moved. And I was going, so what's going on here? Because I think you have to trust the language, you have to trust the integrity and the power and the beauty of the words.
I mean, you mentioned the language, which is interesting, and I think people are always amazed and at the degree of inventiveness in Shakespeare's language, and that so much of the phrases and individual words that we regard as simply our common parlance were Shakespearean inventions.
Exactly.
I offer a toast. The undiscovered country.
Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1.
You have not experienced Shakespeare until you have read him in the original Klingon.
Tach, pa, tach, be.
Now, for those of our listeners who don't speak Klingon fluently, that was the to be or not to be soliloquy from Hamlet. There is a real question, I think, of how far one can stretch and change and play with any work of art, and especially Shakespeare, before it becomes absurd. Can that impulse go too far in modernizing, transforming Shakespeare?
If you don't respect the play in the process, yeah. I think the other side of it is that if you present him with such reverence, you're not honoring him either. Anytime I think you create art, I think you create a mess. I mean, Hamlet is a mess. Now, what you try to do is try to craft a world where the mess of his process of trying to find himself and know himself and get to know how to transform feeling into action is very important, that you create a world that is clear so that, therefore, you can then see that. If the world that you create obscures that, that's a problem. At the same time, if you are sitting there reciting his language as if it is poetry, though it is poetic, then you're not allowing an artist to get inside of the emotional state of it. So I think it works both ways. Purity is a dangerous word, but I'll say it. The purity of that vision, is, in Hamlet's case, is a person who is completely and totally falling apart.
Has that pendulum swung too far in the latter direction with these attempts, for instance, the film version of Romeo and Juliet that came out a few years ago with Leonardo DiCaprio?
I would think that it swings both directions all the time, and I think thus is the process of art. I personally am a very big fan of Romeo and Juliet because I thought it had a visceral power to it that I thought was just exhilarating. One, I think he's a brilliant filmmaker.
Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene. From ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean.
It was a very arresting and very disturbing and deeply compelling version of the play. I'm more attracted to art that smashes than I am attracted to art that sits on a shelf and is beautiful.
Juliet!
From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life.
This month is the 450th birthday of William Shakespeare. I spoke with the director and producer and playwright George C. Wolfe long, long ago, back at the turn of the century. We love hearing about works of art and entertainment that have changed people's lives. And today we'll hear from one listener who had his aha moment. It's a theme, watching Shakespeare. Jeff House listens to the show on San Francisco's KQED, and his story starts when he was a teenager, just watching TV.
My first exposure to Shakespeare came from my very bright sister. I remember she came home one night and told us that Christopher Plummer was doing a performance of Hamlet, and we had to see this because it was just this terrific play your teacher had told her all about. And, of course, I thought, well, fine, we'll watch. It was television. How bad could it be?
To be or not to be, that is the question.
My sister was enthralled and I was bored, silly.
Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them.
The language obviously made no sense, and deals with a young man who is dealing with the ultimate questions of our existence, our sense of identity, and who we are and what's important to us.
It is a consummation devoutly to be wished.
To paraphrase Shakespeare, I thought he was much ado about nothing. I couldn't figure out what Hamlet's whole concern was. Well, when I was 23, I went through a series of experiences that created sort of the emotional perfect storm. Within 1 year, I lost the faith that I had been a member of since childhood, and as a result of that, became estranged from my family. And then to top it all off, I had been involved in probably my first very serious relationship, and that crashed. And I can remember having a strong sense of having failed. It became increasingly difficult for me just to function. One of the many things I decided to do to get myself back out into the world was taking some shows and stuff. And we had a local theater in Los Gatos, and they ran a special season ticket price for students. And I think it was probably after I bought the ticket that I saw the very first show was Hamlet. And I thought, I've already figured out this guy is not worth my time. But I figured, you know, what the heck. And if I don't like it, obviously, I can just get up and leave the theater, which is pretty much what I thought I was going to do. I sat in the very back row, and I began to watch the show. And this was a young man who suddenly had found his world turned upside down. He had to deal with not only the loss of his father, but with the suspicion that his uncle was involved in this. So he was estranged from his family. He went for comfort to his girlfriend, who more or less sided with her father. And Hamlet realizes that he's lost her and she's betrayed him as well. He's completely alone. And he has no sense of his purpose. He has no sense of what's important anymore. I was stunned. So now I was watching my life on stage, and I wanted to see what happened. What I wasn't prepared for was the fifth act, and he has the gravedigger scene. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio. A fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times. And now, how abhorred in my imagination it is, my gorge rims at it. In talking to Horatio and talking to the grave digger, he's surrounded by death. And of all the obstacles and blocks in our lives, this is the ultimate one. And he finally gets to the end of his speech with Horatio. And he talks about, you know, we have no control over our lives. We defy augury. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If we don't want something to happen, it's going to happen. If we want it to happen, it won't happen. And then he makes the four-word phrase that became the motto for my life, which is, the readiness is all. Because that was very hard with my upbringing to conceive that people with flaws could actually be admirable. And here I admired the heck out of a guy that at times is just about unbearable to watch. And I think it was important for me because it suggested that you can change, that what you are born with or what you were born into is not destiny, it's not fate. So whatever your circumstances are, the challenge of your existence is to say, this is what I have, these are the tools. This is what I'm going to work with. The readiness is all. I did go back to school, and as part of going back to school, I went to get my teaching credential in English literature. And then eventually I began teaching Hamlet. And I remember being a teenage boy, not understanding all the anger, the frustration, the extreme emotion that Hamlet displays. And as I deal with my students, I always have this mixed response. Part of me wants them, obviously, to understand it. But to a certain degree, you have to have experienced something similar to what he has gone through. So there's a part of me that doesn't want them to understand it. And I always say to them, perhaps there will come a day when you will. And if you do, I can testify this is a play that can teach you a lot about how to deal with that.
That's Jeff House. He listens to the show on KQED in San Francisco. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story with help from Thomas Seeley. And we want to hear your stories. Is there a play or TV show or song or whatever that got you through a confusing or difficult time? If so, drop us a note at studio360.org and we may put your story on the air. There's an article that keeps making the rounds on Facebook, among theater people especially. The headline is 10 Things Theaters Need to Do Right Now to Save Themselves. Thing number one, enough with the goddamn Shakespeare already. I don't agree, but it is worth asking why this one particular 450-year-old British playwright gets so much real estate in American theater. It's also worth asking, what other old plays should we watch if we weren't so devoted to Shakespeare? We sent Richard Paul to ask around.
You'd be forgiven for thinking there were no plays written between the year Shakespeare died, 1616, and the dawn of the 20th century. In fact, I'll bet you've never seen anything older than A Doll's House except for Shakespeare. It's as if the world went several hundred years with no plays. Of course, that isn't true. There was plenty to see. There were Shakespeare's best-known contemporaries, Christopher Marlowe and Ben Jonson, but there are lots of others.
High on my list would be Beaumont and Fletcher's Night of the Burning Pestle.
Michael Whitmore is director of the Folger Shakespeare Library. He likes this quirky little comedy with a postmodern feel about a grocer named Ralph.
Ralph, who goes to see a play and ends up getting involved in being a character in that play.
Come up, Ralph. I'll tell you, gentlemen. Let them but lend him a suit of apparel and necessaries, and by gad, if any of them all blow wind in the tail on him, I'll be hanged.
It's a really loopy play. It's kind of bonkers, and I think we would love it if we could see it today.
And there's Molière, whom you've only read if you took AP French.
I think we'd like most of the plays of Molière.
Howard Sherman ran the American Theater Wing, the people who put on the Tony Awards.
For Molière, I have a particular fondness for School for Wives.
I fall into deep gloom and melancholy when I survey the scene of human folly. Finding on every hand base flattery, self-interest, treachery.
Clearly, this play hasn't aged badly at all.
I recently saw a production of Tis Pity She's a Whore, which was striking and as up to the minute and shocking as one could ask for.
It's by a playwright named John Ford around 1630.
How you've changed in so short a time. You found an expert husband. Yes, that's it. One much cleverer in devising night games than two innocent children as we were.
There's a wonderful play by Susanna Centlivre called The Gaming Table, which is about a series of players. In the way we would think of that term now, they're people who are kind of on the make, romantically, financially.
I may Sir James Cardouble. 7 wins, 5 loses. You have lost it, madam.
Oh, again?
Female playwright, doing terrific work, and it works.
So, considering all that, why don't we have the Oregon Centlivre Festival? Why aren't people lining up for Beaumont in the Park? One reason is the English Civil War, when the Puritans banned pretty much everything that people liked to do that was fun. The theaters were closed, plays were burned. Then came the Restoration. Theater was back, and boy, were they ready for fun.
There's a kind of hedonism in these plays.
That's Heather Nathans, the chair of the drama department at Tufts University. She says the characters in Restoration comedies are all...
I'm going to drink it, smoke it, eat it, sleep with it, whatever, because I could be dead any time now.
Sir Jasper, your servant, where is the odious beast?
He's within in his chamber with my wife. She's playing the wag with him.
This is the best-known Restoration comedy, The Country Wife, from 1675. It's about...
a man who pretends to be impotent so that he can have fun with all of his neighbor's wives.
Nay, she has been too hard for me. Do what I could.
The guy's name is Horner. That's Horner, as in horn dog, as in horny. Yes, it meant the same thing back then. In this scene, Horner has just come out of the room where they keep the china, along with his neighbor's wife. Another wife is trying to drag him back in the room, saying that she wants some china, too.
Oh, Lord, I'll have some. some china too, good Mr. Horner. Don't think to give other people china and me none. Come in with me, too.
Nay, madam, upon my honour, there is none left now.
Nay, I've heard you deny your china before now, but you shan't put me off, so come.
This lady has had the last there.
Yes, madam, to my certain knowledge, he has no more left.
Oh. The thing you realise here is that theatre was not a particularly elevated form of entertainment.
These guys are actually writing much more like sitcom writers used to write. So they're churning out material, and they are catering to popular taste, and they're also catering to sort of in-jokes of the period. So it's not necessarily material that's going to be really clear to a contemporary audience.
Those old plays were pretty disposable. That started to change in the late 19th century. With Ibsen, Strindberg, and Chekhov, and later George Bernard Shaw, Eugene O'Neill, theater was catering to a more sophisticated taste. As for Shakespeare's time, Marlowe had his fans, so did Ben Jonson. Why did Shakespeare outlast them? It's actually because of a new technology that preserved his work.
As we're approaching the vault, we see something that looks like a bank vault door. In fact, that's exactly what it is.
Librarian Richard Kukta brought me down to this vault underneath the Folger Shakespeare Library. In here is a very precious artifact, actually 82 very precious artifacts.
What you can see is this wall of wonderful bindings in front of you is the Folger's collection of first folios.
The first folio is the first edition of the complete works of Shakespeare. Huge thing, more than 900 pages. Members of Shakespeare's company convinced a publisher to put it out 7 years after his death. It was a major financial risk. Ben Jonson came out with the complete works, but
it didn't do the same thing for him that the first folio did for Shakespeare.
Whether Jonson or Beaumont or Centrelever were as good as Shakespeare or not, it's actually beside the point. For 200 years after Shakespeare's death, you couldn't find most of their plays. If you wanted to put on a Ford play or a Fletcher play, you'd be hunting for a copy of the script in some old sheaf of papers. If you wanted Shakespeare, though, that was easy. Shakespeare was printed in a book.
If Shakespeare had been born 50 years before he was, he would have been, I think, a great professional dramatist. But his words wouldn't have gone so far. Once you put those plays into this revolutionary media format, which is the printed book, its ability to fling those words, ideas, and kind of passions associated with the plays is multiplied.
Now we have scholarly editions of Jonson and Marlowe and the rest, but it's hard to break the Shakespeare habit. After all, who really wants to?
I have immortal longings in me. Now, no more. The juice of Egypt's grape shall moist this lip.
For Studio 360, I'm Richard Paul.
Methinks I hear Antony call. I see him.
Forgettable. All the world's a stage. And all the men and women merely players.
That's just what you are.
To thine own self be true.
He thinks the man does protest too much.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be.
You're unforgettable.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate.
Near me or far.
Friends, Romans, countrymen. Lend me your ear.
Like a song of love that clings to me.
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
How thought of you does silly little things to me.
In Studio 360 over the years, we've done a lot of stories dealing with Shakespeare, and now, in honor of the big anniversary, they are gathered in an omnibus at studio360.org. Neil Gaiman on Shakespeare and his work, fake Shakespeare sonnets written by our listeners, one of the alleged other guys who actually wrote all of Shakespeare's plays, lots more. Check it out at studio360.org.
You're unforgettable. In every way.
Still ahead, we're all inspired by the glories and diversity of our natural world, but it takes a certain kind of person to get really worked up about fungus.
You find out facts and information that blow your mind as to
the diversity and complexity and beauty of the world that we have around us that we maybe sometimes don't recognize.
Jeff Vandermeer, author of the Southern Reach sci-fi trilogy, is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Jeff Vandermeer is a science fiction author, I guess, because he's also a fantasy and horror author, and, by the way, a literary fiction writer as well. All of those tendencies feature in his new work, The Southern Reach Trilogy, three brisk novels about a clandestine government agency whose mission is to investigate Area X, a piece of Florida that has been invaded by some otherworldly force. The second novel in the trilogy, Authority, is just about to come out, and the first, Annihilation, follows an expedition of four scientists, all of them women, into Area X. Vandermeer says the premise came to him in a dream.
So I was walking down this tunnel into the earth and seeing these kind of letters on the wall that were or words that were written in some kind of living material. And I came to a point where I knew I was going to see whatever was writing them because the words were getting fresher, so to speak. And at that point, my writer brain, I think, basically decided to airlift me out. And I woke up and I wrote down the words on the wall and also what I just experienced. And if I had seen what was there, I probably wouldn't have started writing in the morning when I woke up again.
Do you always dream as vividly and specifically as this?
I do, but most of the time it doesn't lead to story. If I don't eventually come to an understanding of a character and what that character wants and where they're going and other details, then it's just a dream that might be possibly entertaining to tell to a friend and maybe not.
Yeah. Well, and saying, I had a dream and then I decided to write a novel about it, sounds like one of those things that would-be writers come up to you at events and say.
Sure, absolutely. And it could have easily have come to me from a newspaper clipping or anything else because you get into this state where whatever, you know, certain things kind of interconnect and layer on each other. So the conscious impulse was that for a long time I've been wanting to write about Florida in some way or that kind of southern wilderness. And so the conscious prompt was that. And then this other thing kind of connected with it. And then the character of the biologist came into my mind.
Florida, where you live,
yes.
I want to mention. You persuaded a rock band, Murder by Death, to write music based on one of your earlier books called Finch. Before I have you read a little bit from Annihilation, is there some band you'd like us to play under the passage?
Well, there is actually a great song by Murder by Death that kind of fits some of this. But there's also, I have to say, all of the Tindersticks movie music and most of Mogwa's music I was listening to while I was writing this stuff. So,
well, let's go with Murder by Death since you guys have some history. If you could read from near the beginning when the team of scientists have entered this mysterious tower for the first time and they see the weird gunk growing on the walls.
All right. Don't touch it, whatever it is, the anthropologist warned. I nodded, but I was too enthralled with the discovery. If I'd had the impulse to touch the words on the wall, I would not have been able to stop myself. In as calm a voice as I could manage, aware of the importance of that moment, I read from the beginning aloud. Where lies the strangling fruit that came from the hand of the sinner, I shall bring forth the seeds of the dead to share with the worms that... Then the darkness took it.
That is Jeff Vandermeer reading from his novel Annihilation. So it's, I don't think it's a huge spoiler to say that the tower ends up being a living thing with all sorts of fungi and moss and spores. Do you dream about fungi or has this been a long-term fixation? You write a lot about it.
I think it's actually a fairly small component of this book and not at all in the second, but it has been a preoccupation in the past just because, again, you know, some people have kind of mentioned literary influences for this book, and in actual fact, I think more of the natural world is in this book than literary influences. And so, you know, I study a lot of I'm kind of an amateur biologist in a way, and I study a lot of this stuff, and you find out facts and information that just kind of blow your mind as to the diversity and complexity and beauty of the world that we have around us that we maybe sometimes don't recognize.
So does it make you sort of PETA-ish about eating mushrooms now?
No. Fruiting bodies are perfectly fine.
In Annihilation, as you say, there's lots of descriptions of the Area X landscape. And you wanted to write about it and this part of Florida where you live because, oh, this eco-apocalyptic novel I have in mind would work really well here where I live?
No, it's actually just – it kind of came naturally to me. Once I had the character, the biologist, down and an idea of who she was and then the other characters, there's this 14-mile hike I do out at St. Mark's Wildlife Refuge. And it's kind of like when you know somebody –
That's a serious hike.
It's a serious hike. It is. It's one of those things where you wind up jumping over alligators and being charged by wild boars and
cool.
All kinds of stuff. But the thing there is just simply that just like when you – take somebody that you know and you use them as the basis for a character. The same thing is sometimes true of a setting. And so it is transformed. It is accurate to some degree, but it's definitely kind of one degree separated from the reality of the place.
And maybe you'll be good for tourism now and people will come to
right,
find
there'll be,
these
there'll
horrible
be
things.
Southern Reach tours in St. Mark's.
And your biologist character, who's the main character, is with the psychologist, the anthropologist, the surveyor. Why no names?
Well, there's a practical reason that the Southern Reach, the secret agency sending in these expeditions, does that. And that's because the first expeditions that use names as opposed to functions, that use modern technology like smartphones and whatnot, came to horrible, horrible ends. And it seemed like those that names and also certain forms of communication were very easily exploited by whatever's there. And so there is that aspect. But then also, without the names, they kind of are subsumed by the landscape a little bit more. You have to interpret them more by their actions, their words, their interactions, and I found that very interesting.
It seems artier and more literary, too.
I don't know that I've really thought about that. I'm not really that calculating in that way.
I'm sure not. But why four women? All these main characters are women.
It came to me as four women, and then I just decided not to change it because there are certain things you just don't change. That keep working with. And then after a while, I just thought it was kind of cool that they were four women and I just went with it.
You are setting up a lot of things in this not long book. we by the end, there's a lot of known unknowns and it seems like probably even more unknown unknowns. At the end of the next two, will everything be clear and all loose ends tied up?
That's a very good question. I think Authority, which is kind of an exploration or expedition into the Southern Reach, the secret agency, just like Annihilation is an expedition to Area X, will show how it's possible to reconcile some of those things because this is a very paranoid agency. It isn't sharing a whole lot of information and sometimes for what it feels are good reasons. So the answer is yes, you will get the answers that you need and you want. I don't know that all the characters will ever find out everything because
who cares about the characters?
Exactly, yeah. Who cares? Who cares about what they know or don't know? But yes, readers will be, I think, satisfied. But I also do like to leave some ambiguity in things. As in life, we don't ever find out everything.
I'd like to have you read some more, if you would. At a certain point in Annihilation, we know there have been earlier expeditions to Area X and that our biologist husband was on one of them. She ends up finding this journal that he'd kept. If you could read from that.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll score it again with a little more music from the band Murder by Death.
Instead, the same habitat confronted them day after day. "We're heading north," I believe he wrote, "but even though we cover a good 15 to 20 miles by nightfall, nothing has changed. It is all the same." Although he also was quite emphatic that he did not mean that they were somehow caught in a strange recurring loop, yet he knew that, by all rights, we should have encountered the border by now. Indeed, they were well into an expanse of what he called the Southern Reach that had not yet been charted. Quote, "that we had been encouraged by the vagueness of our superiors to assume existed back beyond the border. I, too, knew that Area X ended abruptly not far past the lighthouse. How did I know this? Our superiors had told us during training. So, in fact, I knew nothing at all."
Jeff Vandermeer reading from his novel Annihilation. It seems to me as if in the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years, that the ghettos that existed for most of the 20th century between here's science fiction in its little ghetto, here's fantasy in its little... those borderlands are breaking down, and that like good stories are good stories, and literary authors are doing fantasy and science fiction. Does that feel that way to you?
It feels like it first came about because of pop culture and kind of a certain commodification, which was actually like a step back. And then it became something where Margaret Atwood and a few others.
You mean the Star Wars?
Yeah, I actually think that was a step back because it became reflected in the literature a little bit. And it became harder to do something that if you had influences that were like Kafka, that you could get away with it within those imprints. But now, like you said, the borders are kind of breaking down. For me, where I always have felt like I have a foot in both camps and belong to neither in a way, it's both interesting and just kind of the way I operate anyway.
It does seem like the camps that still exist are science fiction versus fantasy among writers and readers. You are straddling both.
Right. Well, I mean, and even in the second novel, Authority, I thought, how do I write a supernatural novel that isn't supernatural? And so there's all kinds of things going on. I just pretty much ignore labels as much as I humanly can.
And how do the members of each reader community regard you, as some kind of weird crossbreed trying to have it both ways?
Or? No, I don't think so. I think they each take from it what they see.
Well, since you so carefully consider what music should accompany your work, is there a song before I let you go that we should play you out on?
Wow, that's a tough one.
The Jeff Vandermeer anthem.
My gosh, I'm not. I think something from 3 Mile Pilot. I think there's a song with C in the title on one of their albums, and that's a good one.
We'll find it. Jeff Vandermeer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Vandermeer is the author of the Southern Reach trilogy. The first installment, Annihilation, is out right now, and the second book, Authority, will be out in May. And that is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisfirm,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Also, I wanted to mention, a couple of weeks ago, we ran a story about the dance piece Four Chambers, and we should have mentioned that the music for that piece was composed by Jonathan Melville Pratt.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Come to me.
Scarlett Johansson plays an alien angel of death in Under the Skin, a new sci-fi film that's unlike anything you've ever seen.
We see, you know, the horror of things, the beauty, savagery, kindness. To look at that through her eyes is to re-see it.
The director Jonathan Glazer, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.